It's 4:06 and you're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll learn how art played a big role in activism at the recent Paris Climate Summit.
First, in the wake of the huge public response to the Netflix docuseries called Making a Murderer, two petitions are currently in the works with the aim of helping to get Stephen Avery pardoned.
Avery was convicted of murdering photographer Teresa Halbach in 2005. He's currently serving a life sentence. The documentary, told from the point of view of Avery's defense, points to what they see as holes in the case. Others involved in the case, though, have said that not all the evidence pointing to Avery was included in the series.
The petitions have hundreds of thousands of signatures online, but when it comes to pardoning, Governor Scott Walker has repeatedly said he will not issue any pardons during his time in office, saying he doesn't want to undermine the criminal justice system, which already has a mechanism for dealing with a change in sentence, he says.
Regardless of the merits in Avery's case, Walker's stance makes him unique among governors in the country. Earlier this week, we asked Governor Walker to join us on the show to talk about his stance, but he was unable to join us. In an interview on WTMJ in Milwaukee, the governor had this to say.
A pardon shouldn't be based on a TV show. A discussion about this should be based on evidence.
Joining us now is P.S. Ruckman Jr. He's a professor of political science at Rock Valley College in Illinois, and he's the editor of the Pardon Power blog and is currently co-authoring a history of pardons. P.S. Ruckman, welcome to Central Time.
I'm glad to be with you. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start off by looking at the difference between a pardon and a commutation. Can you set us straight on what they are?
Well, I think that is important, especially in terms of kind of understanding the way Mr. Walker has talked about the topic and how misleading it is. A pardon simply restores rights. Most pardons, as in 99%+, are granted people who committed minor offenses, nonviolent, years ago, usually many times decades ago. And they've served their time, if they ever even had any time. And they've been law-abiding citizens, and the pardon simply restores their rights. That's all it does. No one's being sprung from jail. No one's sentences are being overturned. The criminal justice system isn't being undermined, not in any sense of the language. A commutation, on the other hand, simply reduces the severity of a sentence. So reducing a death sentence to life in prison or life in prison without the possibility of parole to life with the possibility of parole or reducing a fine. So those are critical distinctions to make at the front of this.
And what kind of rights are we talking about with a pardon?
Well, it'll vary from state to state and at the federal level as well. But typically, the baseline is usually the right to vote, serve on a jury, own a hunting rifle. And then sometimes there are things like travel restrictions involved in restoration of rights or where they're lifted. So there's a pretty good variety, but the baseline is, again, voting, serving on a jury, holding a public office is another one that occurs to me.
Well, let's check out our history a little bit here. What is the underlying philosophy behind the pardon power in the U.S. Constitution, and how does that extend to governors?
Well, the classic mistake is to kind of link it to the King of England, and of course, we don't have kings here. The clemency power is part of our constitutional framework, our system of checks and balances. And so the assumption is that the legislative branch and the judicial branch are not perfect, and I can't even imagine who would disagree with that, even Scott Walker, if asked. And so it's put in our Constitution as a check and a balance, and, of course, it's been incorporated into the states for that matter. So for a governor just to announce outright, I will pardon no one or grant no pardons, is in essence to say, you know, I refuse to perform my constitutional duty, which is very, very bizarre. There are admittedly some governors who don't pardon very much, but I don't know of any case ever where a governor just announced outright, explicitly, I'm not going to do this in any circumstance. In my mind, that's unprecedented.
And the governor has said that repeatedly in different ways, depending on when he's asked or what case he's referring to. But he has said it on the grounds that he doesn't want to undermine the criminal justice system. And here's Governor Walker responding to a question of pardons.
There are many people who don't have advocates for them. And one of the challenges I've always had is, you know, where do you draw the line on that? The bottom line is there's a lot of people in low-income situations who won't have an advocate. Is it fair for them that a couple cases get a high profile, but others who might have an even greater need and may not have an opportunity to be employed in other areas don't have that kind of attention or focus?
And that was not referring to the Stephen Avery case. He has been asked about that. But the case here being, not everyone, for example, is going to have a Netflix documentary series about their case that draws into question the prosecution there or the sentencing. And so why privilege that person over someone else who doesn't have that Netflix series? Is that sound reasoning?
Well, you know, first of all, clemency doesn't undermine the criminal justice system. It's part of the criminal justice system. And again, it's a big mistake to confuse pardons with commutations here. Pardons rarely have ever anything to do with innocence whatsoever. They simply restore rights. I think on the state webpage there for Wisconsin, I noticed almost 1,000 of them have been granted since 1977 or so. And I would be surprised if anyone listening to this program could name two of them, because our criminal justice system, we're over-incarcerated. Way too many people are being put in prison. And our laws are over-criminalized. And those are things the left and the right have been agreeing on recently. So Walker could be pardoning people by the dozens every day. There'd be no controversy. There'd be no loss of political capital to his now ill-fated presidential campaign. And people would be getting what they deserve. You know, commutations, on the other hand, they are a little more controversial, but they're part of our checks and balances system. No one, I don't think, argues people should be pardoned because there's a TV show. You know, that's a straw man. There's no one arguing that. But on the other hand, I think if you cut that down to size, in essence, what Walker is saying, I can't do justice in one case because, to be fair, that would require me to do justice in other cases. And in my humble opinion, that amounts to a very ludicrous defense. It's his job. It's the job of the governor to do justice and to exercise the clemency power. And it just doesn't impress me to hear him say, well, if I help one person, then I'll have to help other people. That doesn't strike me as a good justification for not pardoning or granting clemency. It doesn't impress me much.
We're talking right now with P.S. Ruckman, Jr., professor of political science at Rock Valley College in Illinois, and he's the editor of the Pardon Power blog. As we look at Governor Walker's decision not to grant any pardons during his tenure as governor, this has come up recently in reference to the Netflix series Making a Murderer and the case of Stephen Avery. And you've said that you think Governor Walker is behind the times on this, that in general, that pardons are on the upswing in the United States with governors, and there's more sort of bipartisan agreement about them, making them less controversial. Tell us why you think he might be behind.
I do believe that. And, you know, before we get away from it, it's worth mentioning that the pardon power is smart, if you will. It's subtle, and it's not nearly the kind of the blunt instrument that Walker seems to make it out to be. He doesn't have to, for example, pardon the people that are involved in this documentary. That's not his only option. He could commute the sentence. He could commute it to life with the possibility of parole and let a parole board study this, potentially study it for years and years. So it's not a matter of kind of, as he paints the picture, all he can do is kind of, you know, bust in the prison, open up the doors, and throw the judgment of judges and juries out the window, or do nothing. That's a false choice. There are many options there. And around the states, increasingly, I think there is a sense that the left and the right, the political left and the right, are agreeing that prisons are not working. They're overcrowded. They're ineffective. They're not rehabilitating. Those are things the left have been tuned in for a while. And now with budget concerns, the right is starting to kind of see it's costly, it's expensive, there are probably, you know, more affordable ways to do things. And again, there's a concern about laws being over-criminalized. We're not cracking down on crimes that are very vicious so much as we are making the less serious crimes more serious and punishing them more seriously. And around the states, you do see governors granting, I feel, there's a kind of a trend toward greater pardoning. One of the things we've seen in recent election cycles is people running for governor who promised to pardon, who promised to take it seriously. And you would have never seen that in the 80s. That a candidate like that would have been kind of, you know, shot down right away as, you know, being soft on crime, that type of thing. So I think that's indicative of a sea change among governors. And, of course, that's reflective of changes in public opinion.
And we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you.
That was P.S. Ruckman, Jr., professor of political science at Rock Valley College in Illinois. He's the editor of the Pardon Power blog and is currently co-authoring A History of Pardons. And we were talking there about Governor Walker's decision not to grant any pardons during his tenure as governor. Thousands of climate activists took to the streets of Paris last month during the historic 2015 United Nations Climate Change Conference, commonly referred to as COP21.
Our next guest was one of those activists who, leading up to the event, wanted to bring artists together with the activist movements.
Nicholas Lampert is a senior lecturer in the Art and Design Department of the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and also author of the book A People's Art History of the United States. Nicholas, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me on the air.
So why is art such an important part of big demonstrations and movements?
Well, it's vital for a couple of reasons. First, it communicates externally. It creates a lot of the visuals that the media captures. It really captures a lot of the slogans and of the movement, of what the movement's calling for. And it also communicates internally. It really inspires those who are dedicating their life and their energy to climate justice, and it really brings people together.
Tell us a little bit about how you've been involved in the art and activism movements.
Well, I've been involved in art and activism for about 2 decades, but recently I helped co-organize a project called climateprints.org with 4 other people, 3 of which are from Wisconsin and 2 are from New York. And what climateprints.org is, it's a website that is it's really a movement infrastructure tool. It's a website that allows artists and designers from around the world to submit graphics dealing with environmental issues to us, and if we think they're strong graphics and they'd be useful in the global climate justice movement, we will upload them. And then anyone in the world can download these high-resolution graphics for free under a Creative Commons license, and we help connect these artists and these graphics with movements. So environmental groups are using these graphics in their flyers and their banners and so forth. So it's really a way to harness the power of artists in this movement.
I spent some time looking at the Climate Prints website, and I have to say the art is pretty remarkable. If you want to look at purely for art's sake and not look at the social message or the environmental message there's still a lot of beauty and striking art to be found. Do you want the two causes to be intertwined, the art and the activism, or are you okay with people just admiring the art?
That's fine. I mean, I think artists have to create strong work for it to communicate. So we're pushing artists to create the best work that they can for these causes. But at the same time, we're really not trying to be hierarchical. I get really inspired when, say, a high school student or a freshman college student submits this incredible graphic, and it might be the first graphic that they've ever made on an environmental campaign, but it's up on our site, and it's powerful, and it's being used. And our site has examples of artists who are very new to making this type of art to some of the most well-known political artists in the world. And also, we're really trying to make sure that the site isn't so U.S.-centric. So we're starting to get artists from India and Turkey and South America submitting work. So it's starting to take on a much more global feel.
And you were at the climate change conference in Paris that happened recently. It looked like that was a huge event for art. What was that experience like?
The experience was remarkable. I'm still processing it. Basically, about 4 or 5 months before the climate conference, we want to make sure that we got the climateprints.org site up and running so that it'd be useful. But immediately we started networking with the environmental group 350.org and realizing that this was a really good platform to put up graphics to promote the demonstrations, because the climate conference, obviously world leaders, 195 countries came together and met to hash out this agreement. You had world leaders, but the public was out in the streets. And so obviously a lot changed with the terrorist attacks, but on December 12th, you still had 15,000 people out in the streets for really voicing their demands and really asserting the narrative that a lot of this movement is being driven by the grassroots, by grassroots groups. So we went there with the purpose to make art for that December 12th demonstration. And it was an incredible site, a space right outside of Paris called the Jardin des Alice that was essentially an art factory. It had about 300 artists working around the clock, making art, making banners, posters, you name it, for these for this massive demonstration.
We're talking to Nicholas Lamper right now, senior lecturer in the Art and Design Department at the University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and author of A People's Art History of the United States, talking about his involvement with art and activism at the recent Paris Climate Change Conference. And you talk there about an artist named, I might be mispronouncing it, but Solnit, and how he was such a key player in getting this art up there. Tell us about him.
Dave Solnit truly is remarkable. He's a Bay Area artist, and he's someone who I think would probably identify as an arts organizer. He really has zero interest in the mainstream art world, the world of even museums and galleries, and he makes art for movements, and he's been doing this for many decades. And he is now the arts organizer for 350.org, and he helped really lead this space, this warehouse space in Paris, to help construct a lot of the art that was seen in the December 12th demonstration. For instance, we painted two 300-foot banners, and we, you know, this giant, giant red banner with the words that said, it's up to us to keep it in the ground, which obviously referred to keep fossil fuels in the ground. And when that 300-foot banner is carried through the streets of Paris and underneath the Eiffel Tower and photographed, that became some of the iconic images that traveled through social media and through the press, and it's covered on the Guardian newspaper and so forth. And it's, you know, really proof positive that these demonstrations, when they're really vibrant and creative and your message gets out there, that it becomes a form of media. And David Solnit is truly one of the great artists at mastering this.
Can you describe some of the other art events? I know you begin one list of them with some kind of mini icebergs that have been shipped from Greenland that were just placed in front of some of the major meeting halls.
Sure. I mean, being in Paris for those 2 weeks was unbelievably inspiring, because there was just art happening all over the city. I was involved in creating a lot of the banners that were part of that December 12th demonstration, but there was artists from all over the world doing other projects. There was an artist from Greenland named Olafur Eliasson, who, with a scientist, brought 12 large icebergs from Greenland and placed them in front of the Pantheon, a famous building in Paris. And during the duration of the conference, these 12 icebergs stood in this very public square and slowly melted. And it was very metaphoric of a planet whose temperature is obviously too high, and the melting of the polar ice caps. And, you know, that was a very metaphoric piece. I went by about 5 or 6 times during my time there, and there was always crowds there, people photographing it, and there was all types of art happening. That was just one example. There was other groups that were doing nighttime projections where they were projecting 1.5 degrees Celsius on the Eiffel Tower. There was, you know, art was happening everywhere. And to me, it just speaks to the power that art has, but also that in this time that we live in, you really need creative people using their talents to solve some of these world problems.
What do you think art can get at, can evoke for people that just, you know, handing out a pamphlet couldn't get at?
Well, I think it's like, as I said, I think it's just very metaphoric and powerful, and it just tugs at the heartstrings. And it's, art is something that can really break down very complex issues to its basic narrative. And the way, you know, obviously other forms of media and art are very powerful, such as novels and films, but a powerful graphic can say it all. And movements throughout history have really relied on artists as a part of as a force. And so the climate justice movement and the issue of global warming is something that we are dealing with every day. And artists can really put this issue out in front in the public on a daily basis. And that's hopefully what will happen.
What do you think is coming up next for you, both with Climate Prints and for art in general, as a form of activism?
It remains to be seen, because so much of our energy went into Paris. But Climate Prints is going to continue to grow. We're going to make the site bilingual this coming year. I know just my experience being in Paris is many of these activists coming from all over the world, and it was just really exhilarating to be in a room where you're working at a table and you're asking people where they're from, and people are saying they're from the Arctic, or they're from Australia, or they're from India, or they're from Indonesia, that people are energized. And it's a type of movement where I think the grassroots is really mobilizing. These campaigns are local. And I know that a lot of the energy coming out of Paris is going towards an action called Break Free, which is happening towards in late spring, where campaigns, where 350.org and other organizations are leading a campaign where there are going to be civil disobedience actions at the major extraction industry sites around the world.
And we leave it there. Nicholas, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That is Nicolette Lampert from University of Wisconsin-Milwaukee and author of the book A People's Art History of the United States. There's been a lot of news recently about Flint, Michigan. In 2014, Flint's emergency manager made the decision to switch the city from Detroit's water system to the Flint River. It was meant to be a cost-cutting measure that ended up having dire consequences for city residents.
Soon after that switch, residents began complaining that the water tasted strange, that the water seemed cloudy or discolored. As time progressed, doctors in the area started noticing that children coming in for tests had elevated levels of lead in their bloodstreams.
This story, which has dominated the news, has forced the resignation of top government officials in Michigan, and there have been calls for Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder to resign. He addressed the need for sweeping changes to his state's infrastructure in his State of the State address this week.
In addition to the issues in Flint, we have a statewide infrastructure challenge. Flint is not alone. Michigan is not unique. We have a national problem with our infrastructure. Michigan's infrastructure was ranked D by the American Society for Civil Engineers. Worse than the national ranking, which was a D+. We need to get this right in Michigan for the long term. We need to invest more and smarter in our infrastructure so we can avoid crises like this in the future.
As the governor pointed out, Flint and Michigan are not alone. People following the story, from engineers to environmental lawyers, have pointed out that as infrastructure continues to age in cities and other communities around the country, we could see similar issues cropping up. Joining us now to discuss the news out of Flint and what we can learn from it is Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic's City Lab. Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
So we've summed up what's been going on in Flint there. This is a big crisis. This is not a small thing to be swept under the rug. Do you see this opening people's eyes to the water that they take for granted?
Yeah, absolutely. It does flag some huge national issues with aging infrastructure, as you mentioned. Although I do think it's important to point out that we're seeing more and more evidence come out that the issue in Flint was really more a failure of government than it was infrastructure. It really had to do with a choice related to the water itself. But yeah, I mean, that said, like Flint, cities all over the country are watching their water infrastructure, reach the end of its lifetime. Most pipes in this country, or a huge portion of them, are over a century old.
Let's focus in on Flint a little bit and talk about where oversight might have gone wrong. Can you talk about the various levels of oversight that didn't flag this problem, didn't publicize it, didn't tackle it as early as they could have?
Yeah, I mean, I think it really remains to be seen, or at least certainty has really sort of yet to emerge here. The State Department of Environmental Quality, the Michigan Attorney General, and the federal EPA are all involved in investigations, sort of, asking that very question. But it does seem that there's really no level of government here that really can claim clean hands. This was a city issue. a state level issue, especially given that, you know, the city of Flint was under an emergency manager when this decision was made. Because of its financial issues, right, this is a cost-cutting measure that really went overboard.
Well, on a human level, talk about some of the consequences for the people who had been drinking this water, hopefully are not still drinking this water in Flint. What kind of things are we seeing, might we be seeing for years to come?
Yeah, so, you know, the sort of really huge concern for many of the parents in Flint is the effects that lead poisoning can have on young children. Young children absorb lead at much higher rates than adults do. And what's particularly scary about that is that, you know, the effects are kind of nebulous and don't always manifest until years down the line. And those effects include brain damage and neurological issues, you know, lowered IQ, behavioral issues. And of course, it's also, you know, demands mentioning that, you know, there's been this outbreak of Legionnaires' disease. 10 people have died, and many experts believe that that bacteria is also linked to the water supply.
Talking to Laura Bliss from the Atlantic City Lab about the water crisis in Flint, Michigan, and lessons we can learn here in Wisconsin and around the country. Laura, you start your most recent piece on Flint by talking about the value of water and how we think of water. Is it a public service? Is it a utility? Is it a commodity? How do you think we should be thinking of water to make sure we're paying the attention we need to make sure these things don't happen?
Yeah, it's a really interesting question that, you know, economists and utilities and all kinds of people grapple with. But I think the story of Flint is a really great example about why it's really important to think about water as a service that we're paying for rather than, you know, the commodity itself, if you will, of water. You know, we pay for water to be treated and conveyed, you know, to our taps safely. And you know, an adequate quantity. And that's really how it's priced. That's really what we're being charged for. You know, the vast majority of utilities really do charge for treatment and conveyance and not the molecules themselves. So that's what we're paying for, and that's really what needs, you know, what government and utilities need to be held accountable to. And that said, it's water is also a human right. You know, that is the opinion of the UN. You know, I think it goes past the sort of question of convenience when you're talking about water as a human right. You know, this really taps into affordability issues to ensure that people have access to safe and adequate water.
Right. That's another part of the story in Flint. People were paying a lot of money for access to this water that turned out to be potentially hazardous.
Yeah, like between $100 and $200 a month, which is many, many times above the national average. Absolutely. And that gets into, you know, really what is, you know, partly at the root of this whole situation, which is, you know, Flint has seen just a massive population loss over the last couple of decades. And as a result, you know, there are fewer utility customers to spread this cost out to. And so individual ratepayers are really getting gouged. And you know, in a situation like this, it's just, you know, saying that it adds insult to injury is an understatement.
And this is something you could see happening in a lot of other places, either industrial cities where the industrial base is gone, population, like as you just mentioned, Flint is happening. You could see a rural area maybe with declining populations. We have counties like that in Wisconsin. It's a cost issue. Counties, municipalities, cities don't have the money to pay for this, and updating these systems is going to be really expensive, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there are many people in the water industry who sort of look at this as a you know, like the, that the, they believe that the water industry should sort of act more like you know, energy, and you know, that there should be sort of greater connectivity between different water systems in order to achieve, you know, greater economy of scale. But I think what you're also getting at is this question of aging infrastructure. You know, which is, again, a problem that, you know, virtually every city in the country faces. And yeah, well, again, I wouldn't want to conflate the problems in Flint with, you know, their infrastructure per se. It absolutely is part of the story, and a big challenge for the whole nation.
I saw one analyst suggest that drinking water, in a way, has been a victim of its own success. It's there in a tap. We turn it on. We rely on it. We don't think about it until something scary, something horrible like this happens. Do you think at least one small upside is that we're going to stop taking this for granted and start confronting whether it's the infrastructure, whether it's the cost, the issues that face our drinking water?
I really hope so. Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely true. You know, water systems in particular are designed to last for a very long time. You know, so when a lot of the pipes around the country were installed a century ago, it was kind of like, you know, dust our hands of that and sort of look away. And like you mentioned, it's totally, it's underground, it's out of sight and out of mind. But yeah, you know, there's been reports that sort of peg the cost of replacing aging infrastructure around the U.S. at $1 trillion, and that's a huge amount of money. But I think it's important to recognize, you know, and Flint is sort of a reminder that those costs are only going to grow, you know, the longer we sort of put our heads in the sand about this.
We're talking about Flint's water crisis, what we could learn from it with Laura Bliss. She's been covering the story for CityLab.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you think cities are investing enough in the pipes that deliver water to residents? Should we look at new technology to avoid water contamination? And are you worried about the water in your community? Let us know at 800-642-1234. We're talking about the Flint water crisis and how we could see similar issues crop up throughout the country as infrastructure gets older and less reliable.
Are you worried about the drinking water in your area? We want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Should we be paying more attention to where our water is coming from, how it gets to us, and what it might encounter along the way? Call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page as we continue our conversation with Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer at CityLab. That's a project by The Atlantic. Go to our callers now. We've got Mike on the line in Portage. Mike, hi.
Hello. I was calling
Go ahead, Mike.
It's not that I was. Hello, can you hear me?
Yep, go ahead.
Okay, it's been decades that I've been reading about the writing on the wall that about water shortages and that the real problem is water use. You know, we have lawns that are the most farm crop in America. We have sprinkler systems and just pools and everything that we use water for that if we charge for it, what it's worth relative to its rarity, you know, 1% of water on the earth is drinkable, then that would solve the problem. But we don't charge for it, and we waste it. So I think we should.
Mike, thanks for the call. I think we just lost you there. But I think we got the gist, Laura, that if we think of water, I guess, more like a commodity, charge what it's worth, he says, charge more for it, it'll discourage waste. We'll use water more efficiently.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of wisdom to that. You know, on the other hand, affordability is a huge thing that water utilities also have to look at. You know, higher water rates might dissuade, you know, wealthier water users from, you know, using more water, although in some cases that's not even true. There was, you know, there were headlines out of California earlier, or last year, I should say, about, you know, people spending close to $100,000 a year on their water, like I was trying to say, it's still really important to factor in, you know, how rates are impacting lower income water customers. There's still that sort of human rights piece that has to factor in.
Thanks a lot for that call. We'll go next to Corey in Madison. Corey, hi.
Hi, I'm a public works engineer, and I just wanted to touch briefly on the cost of redoing this infrastructure. And we have to realize that a lot of our water as well as sewer lines are running underneath our municipal roads. And it's a little bit more than just a matter of replacing pipe. You're tearing up a road to get to that pipe. So the there's a much bigger cost involved than just updating one part of an infrastructure. It's a rather large expense, as well as our wells. Drilling new wells, capping off old wells. There's a lot to this.
And Corey, I wanted to ask, since you're a public works engineer, one criticism of what was done in Flint was the idea that they were looking to save money and made a decision quickly and maybe didn't think through all the variables that they should have. Is updating a water system something that we can do quickly or cheaply, or is this something that we really got to plan? This is like a years, maybe decades long project of planning.
I don't know. There's a lot that goes on behind the scenes, and I don't know exactly what went on in Flint. On the surface, that seems like a real knee-jerk reaction to something. I can't imagine even looking at doing something like that personally. But again, I don't know what the logistics were in Flint and why, their motivation for doing that. But there is. Anytime. And when you backflush a water system, which is normal maintenance, and the water turns a little discolored and people turn on their tap and it looks a little rusty, this upsets everyone. And you walk a fine line with that, tearing up somebody's water line for a summer project. I don't know why Flint did it, but they did.
Corey, thanks a lot for that call. And Laura, let's get into that. One problem people have said is this water from the Flint River plus the pipes that were in Flint, they weren't really compatible. They needed some kind of special treatment that they didn't get. So maybe a hasty job, not the planning that should or maybe even legally was required to happen?
Yeah, right. So the Flint River water was corrosive, like really, really high levels of salt. Right, that's what caused the lead to leach into the water. It seems that there were no anti-corrosive agents mixed into the water before it was delivered to the household, which is pretty common practice. And to my understanding, that was some kind of conflict between EPA standards and Michigan Department of Environmental Quality standards. Again, we're really still sort of waiting on clear answers as to why, that particular decision was made.
We're talking about drinking water, Flint, Michigan, and beyond with Laura Bliss from City Lab. Back to your calls now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jill on the line in Suamico. Jill, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a point that I didn't hear us talk about, and there are so many fingers to point. Why wasn't the emergency management thinking conservation of non-essential water uses like we've heard so much about in other states in the Southwest? I know people are taking more than 10-minute showers, all of these kinds of things. Why wasn't that done? Because I think it was price gouging was part of the, economics of Michigan State. Why isn't there a statewide use of the Great Lakes that is shared into the internal landscape? You know what I mean?
Sure.
With so much better use of money.
Jill, thanks a lot for that call. And Laura, I want to take us to the Great Lakes. That's ultimately going to be the source of Flint's water, right? This Flint River project was a stopgap for a couple of years until they were hooked into this Lake Huron system. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. And from what I understand, just reading the most recent sort of updates on that, that's still the city's plan, as far as I know, even sometime this year, according to the last thing I read, the city expects to be able to hook up to that new pipeline.
Jill, thanks for that call. So bad management, Jill is saying, and it seems like there's an issue of who does the buck stop with? Is it the local government, the emergency manager, the state environmental agency, the county, the EPA? What do you think lessons should be as far as coordination, management? Who makes these decisions? Who sounds the alarms?
Yeah, it's really impossible to say, yes, this decision was made under an emergency manager. It's very possible that, in the absence of that manager, that the same decision would have been made by, city government and by the mayor and staff. So it's kind of hard to answer that question, but I do think that there's a really important lesson here. You know, Flint is like just a really dramatic and tragic example of, you know, a practice that's becoming increasingly common in cities all over the country. You know, between the beginning of the recession and, you know, 2013, something like 28 cities filed for bankruptcy. And, you know, all of the cities from Detroit to San Bernardino to Camden, you know, you can see stories of, you know, police departments, parks departments, libraries, you know, health, public services of all kinds just being really cut down to the bone. And people's lives, you know, suffer, you know, in all of those cases. In Flint, it's a really, really extreme, you know, visible example of that. So I think is a lesson, you know, for taxpayers and for legislators, sort of think about, you know, what is the line here that we draw when we're talking about making budget cuts in cities that are financially struggling? Because I think the story makes clear that there needs to be a line when it comes to such basic services.
Back to our callers now with Ivy on the line in Evansville. Ivy, hi.
From a broader perspective, you often hear politicians rail against regulations. The people, you know, if you have pesticides that pollute your water, you have pollutants, you can't, you know, for a person like myself, if my house were in Flint, I couldn't sell it. Who's going to want to buy it? Regulations protect us. They keep our water safe. But if you look at the economics of it, people who have polluted water as a source are in big trouble, you know, regular people. If you're wealthy, you can move or you can buy bottled water. The people in Flint can't move.
Ivy, thanks a lot for that call. And yeah, this is Flint, a city already known for economic hardship. This is going to make things even worse, make it more difficult to sell a house, probably to attract a business. So these environmental and safety issues, Ivy's saying, Laura, are an important economic issue, too. Are people talking that way when they talk about Flint?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I just read an interview from the current mayor of Flint, and then one of my colleagues at City Lab, and that was absolutely one of the concerns she's voicing. You know, Flint wants people to live there, of course, like any city. So yeah, it's going to be extreme. It's obviously an urgent issue that safe and adequate water supplies are restored. And you know, the city has already switched back to Detroit's water supply, but from there, it's really going to be an issue of restoring the citizens' trust in that water and in their local government, because that's really been shattered here. And that's not going to happen tomorrow. That's going to take some time.
Laura, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That was Laura Bliss. She's a staff writer for the Atlantic Magazine's City Lab. She joined us to talk about the Flint water crisis and possible lessons for the rest of the nation.